This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we're going down an extraordinary path. There is a documentary out there, Accidental Truth, next, Beyond UFO Disclosure, and it really does move beyond UFO disclosure. What are we doing here? What are we doing with disclosure? What does it mean? Why is there so much fear here? What is the dark side that they don't want us to know? Ron James has produced an extraordinary movie called Accidental Truth, next, Beyond UFO Disclosure, that goes deeper, I think, than any other such film ever has. And that said, I want to welcome Ron right now to Dreamland. Hi, Ron. It's good to meet you and see you again. I'm in the movie, and so I have watched it also, so I certainly know a lot about it. I've got many more questions than we can cover, but that's okay. Welcome to the show. And where are you right now? There have been now two documentaries. Can you tell us exactly what the status of both of them is?
Sure. So in 2023, I released Accidental Truth, UFO Revelations. And that was the film that first time Matthew Modine came in and did a narration for me. And that won 28 Film Festival Awards and was billed as one of the best UFO documentaries ever. And people can see it now on YouTube for free. And I didn't want to make another movie until I really felt like I could move the bar. And what I'm realizing is that we have to get past the acknowledgement of non-human intelligence and start thinking about what the broader implications are for humanity. So I made the sequel to Accidental Truth, which is Accidental Truth Next, which you are amazing in. Again, narrated by Matthew Modine. It came out on June 2nd, and it briefly was number one in the world for documentaries. So it's won another 11 film festival awards, and I'm just really gratified that people are checking it out.
Now, the next part is the part that I'm there for, and I think that we're all trying to deal with. Now, the revelation of ATIP came at this point, I believe, 9 years ago. And what has genuinely changed during that period? Because I think we're still dickering around with this, Ron.
No, I think we are, you know, and I'm the minority voice of dissent here, trying to get everybody to understand that the emperor has no clothes. We have been given a repeat performance of things that have happened in the 50s and the 70s regarding disclosure. They didn't even bother to write a new script, it would seem. They just gave us the same old movie. We had high-ranking military officials talking about technology that wasn't ours. We had military people coming forward talking about reverse engineering programs. And Whitley, this wasn't just, you know, last couple of years. This was in the 1950s. So it's been, as we point out in the film, almost a decade since we got Lou Elizondo on stage talking about this stuff. And we really haven't gotten any further down the road for disclosure in any significant way from political process and government.
Now, Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, who was first director of the CIA and who organized a congressional hearing through NICAP in the 1950s, ended up by saying, essentially, it's just to walk away from this. That's essentially what he said. Now, the same thing happened in the 70s. And in the 90s, I was involved with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which was moving in this direction until it just stopped. They quit. They couldn't get anywhere. And they were doing the same thing that the congressional committees have been doing recently, which was subpoenaing or asking for the attendance of, in this case, I believe it was NSA officers in camera in closed session. And they never got beyond that. The last thing I said to the council for that was follow the money, because you're going to find something if you follow the money. And he told me that they had found an airbase that was not on the Pentagon's roster at all. And yet it was full of air people, and they were all being paid and so forth. That was basically the last I heard from them. And it sort of petered out very badly, actually. There were a lot of complications. Anyway, what is your core feeling right now? Because we're skating along again here. I don't see a big moment coming. I see a lot of promises that sort of ooze on slowly down the road.
Yeah, so we're dealing with, you know, what has basically become a cover-up that is so deep that even our front-facing politicians and front-facing people within the Pentagon and the intelligence community do not understand what this is. And that's why we're getting all these weird videos from the Pentagon that they're scraping off of, you know, military records. They're not even talking to the people who really know what's going on. And this cover-up was engineered, as you know, back as early as the late 30s, and it has evolved since then. And the people that are in charge of this, I believe there's a tug of war going on within this small community of people as to what to disclose, if to disclose, and why. And there's some that think that humanity deserves full disclosure, and there's some that thinks we can never allow these secrets to come out. And what we're seeing bubble up in the front-facing arena is the results of this tug-of-war. That's why we have different people. We have David Grush coming forward talking about reverse engineering programs, which I'm sure he was given permission to do. And then we have, still a staunch government denial of everything. And the people that really know what's going on with this, we're never going to know who they are. They're buried deep within government and industry and compartmentalized programs. And there's probably only a handful of people on the planet that have a bird's eye view of this.
There have been numerous rumors around for years that there have been meetings between NHI, basically between the Greys and the official world, presumably, if the Eisenhower one is correct, that would be maybe the first. But there have been more recent ones rumored. And who was it who says, goes into, I think it was Tim Gallaudet, who goes into uses the phrase frankly terrifying in the documentary.
That was Tim Burchett, yeah.
I mean, Tim Burchett. Yeah, of course it was. Well, you know, Tim Burchett knows what it is. And he is not saying. None of them are saying. What made Jimmy Carter cry? Why did... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Whitley. At the very beginning of this, back in 2017, we had all these politicians, Marco Rubio, Chuck Schumer, later followed by Tim Burchett, and later Ana Paula Luna and Eric Burleson, and all of the other ones who are gung-ho for disclosure, right? But over time, something happened. These people had the opportunity to get their security clearances and the ability to be told things that in the beginning they weren't able to be told. And now, instead of getting, we want the public to have the truth, we're going after this, they're saying things like, well, I've been told this and I've been told that, but they're not telling us what they've been told. So they have basically, I call it the devil's deal. You get sucked into a room and the guy says, look, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't share this with the public. And as soon as you agree to that, you have just become an instrument of the narrative. You are no longer a crusader for disclosure. You are part of the cover-up, and you are then fed limited information that you can put out on a limited basis, and you're playing the game. And I've watched this happen to all these different politicians. As soon as they get their security clearances and they get pulled into the rooms, they're all of a sudden saying things like, I've been told this, but I can't share it. When before they were saying, we're going to find out and we're going to tell the people. And so it's been a hard evolution to watch, but it happens to filmmakers, it happens to journalists, and it happens to politicians. And I've been pulled into those rooms where it's like, look, I could tell you this, but you can't put it out. And my answer is always, then don't tell me. I'm going to get my information fair and square. I'm going to put it out to the public, and I am not going to carry the burden of your secret. But there's very few people that are willing to take that stance.
Yeah. You know, I was approached to get a security clearance back in the 90s, in the early 90s, and I said no, for the very reason you're saying this. I think no is the only safe answer, because if I had done that, in my case, I have a very direct relationship with the Grays, and if I ended up in a situation where they wanted me to say something, it was illegal for me to say it, I didn't know then, but I now know they are not into negotiation at all. I mean, they're not, they don't think that way. If I had said to them, I can't say that, I'm glad I didn't just put it, I'm just not going there anymore. Okay, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back. This September 19th and 20th at the beautiful Catamaran Resort on Mission Bay in San Diego, there's going to be something very special happening. It's a deep exploration of consciousness. It's called Explore Quantum Consciousness. I'll be there telling you about a profound breakthrough that I have made in my life with the visitors that has taken me from terror to transformation. There are going to be many speakers at this major event. William Henry will be there. Eben Alexander will be there. Barbara Lamb will be there. Daryl Anka will be there channeling Bashar. Laurie MacDonald will be there. So many others. Paul Hynek will be there. Suzanne Ross, the founder of the program, and Alan Steinfeld, her co-host, will be there. It's going to be a huge and extraordinary experience. Don't miss it. And be sure to join us on the dinner cruise that evening. It is going to be a beautiful out on the water in San Diego. So go to sandiegotranscendenceretreat.com. That's sandiegotranscendenceretreat.com. And sign up right now. I'd love to see you there. I'm looking forward to it very much. I've got some new things to say, and I think they're important. And I think you need to hear them. We're talking to Ron James, his new movie, Accidental Disclosure, next. Ron, where can we find the movie? Where can we get it?
It's at Accidental Truth Next is on Amazon, Apple, and Google Play. And people can see the original Accidental Truth, which is UFO Revelations. That video is available right now on YouTube for free. So they can watch the first one and then enjoy the sequel. I'm actually very proud of this movie. It's caused a lot of controversy, but at the end of the day, that's how you move the ball and you move the conversation, is you bring stuff up that people hadn't thought of and put it together in such a way that it gets people thinking.
Yeah. And, you must have some idea of what this big secret is that nobody will reveal. You have some sense of it. Are you willing to talk about that?
Yeah, I think you probably have just as much. You probably have more insight than I do because of your relationships with some of these beings. But, you know, to me, it's a broader picture of the whole nature of reality and who and what we are, where we fit in the galactic food chain, so to speak. And I think it's just a combination of different things. The fact that there are adversarial and beneficial races, the fact that we just are not in the superior position that we think we are, and the fact that we have absolutely no control over the decisions these beings may make in the future and how that affects us. You know, that's a big part of it. And I'd be interested to hear what you think as well.
Okay, well, I can certainly say a couple of things. There was a violent event that took place in 1989 in the, that's not my dog, folks. I don't have a dog. Okay, somebody's coming in the room that you can't see, I would guess. In any case, it was a violent event, and I don't know much about it except that it caused a big fire. A lot of houses were destroyed. And that was when I knew that there was a lot of conflict here. And the question of why is there, because what is, here's, and you asked me to say, here's what I think may be the case. I think that most species are have a general mind. In other words, they're all linked in the sense that lady up there's only one of her, even though it has many, many physical manifestations, as many physical manifestations it needs to function in the physical world. But it's alone. And I think, I have a feeling that species like us, where everybody is a separate individual, isolated in and of themselves, are probably vanishingly rare. And we are an unbelievably valuable, desirable asset. This makes us absolutely mercurially intelligent. It makes us creative. It creates a space in which all kinds of new things are constantly happening. The most entertaining possible situation for somebody who has always been alone and of themselves only. This is what I believe. Now, that's not big enough to be an official secret as dramatic as the one we're talking about, because that secret is something about us that we would not desperately want to know. And that's what you and I have got to figure out. So just keep going with it.
Well, you get into some of these teachings that that are more obscure, like the Gnostics, and this whole idea that there's, I like to think that we're spiritual beings here having a human experience, and many of our religions teach us that. But then you hear all these other teachings, like that there's layers of reality, and that there's these unseen beings that do not have our best interests at heart, and that our souls are being recycled. The Gnostic teaching says that that when we die, the light is a it's a illusion, and that we are greeted by these beings called archons, and then we're basically wiped of our memory and recycled in some kind of prison planet. And then you've got David Icke saying things like, we're being ruled by a reptilian race that lives inside the planet and controls humanity in many, many ways. And so there's all kinds of very esoteric beliefs, and I'm not trying to say that any of these are correct, but I am saying that there is a whole legend and lore in which our reality, our spiritual beliefs, and everything else do not really apply to the reality these belief systems are teaching us. And so if there's any truth to any of that, like the whole idea of reptilians, or the whole idea of human souls having value that do not necessarily place the individual at the most important position, it just opens up all these different things that leave us with more questions than answers, and could be very disturbing if true.
Yeah, especially if we are a created species, if somebody built this. And that could be the case, because I had Max Rempell on last week. He's a geneticist who's doing a program where he's looking for signs in the genes of close encounter witnesses that would indicate that they have been in some way tampered with. And we talked briefly about looking at the genetic makeup of the species from long ago, but it becomes very difficult. But I have to say, if we went to another world and found a species that could potentially become intelligent, what if I wonder if we might do that. We might do it. We might think to ourselves. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, I was going to say, if intelligent life is persistent in the galaxy, which is not a stretch by any reasonable thought exercise, then there's, you know, probably millions of intelligent species. And once you become a spacefaring species, you have to be able to get along with your cohorts because you have the technology to destroy entire worlds. So just through the necessity of survival, if you're a spacefaring species, you are probably part of what they call the Galactic Federation or whatever. And you have these tenuous, loose alliances with the other members of this. You're not all on the same page. You're vastly different species, but you at least have an uneasy comfort where you're not going to destroy each other. So if that is true, then we have a lot of different races out there doing a lot of different things with a lot of different agendas. And the idea that a planet such as Earth, which is right in the Goldilocks zone, it's a it's an amazing place for DNA, the variety of life, the ability to create things here. There could be a lot of different species with a lot of different interests in things that they can do with a planet like this. And so, you know, evolving humans for whatever reason could be one of them. And there could be many species that have different ideas on how the outcome for humanity should be. And I'm one of those people who believes that we're being allowed to self-determine. And as you so cleverly put it in the movie, they're either midwives or undertakers. And to me, that was one of the most profound statements in the film. It's up to us to decide. But then there are people or, you know, different species standing by to either mop us up and do something different with the planet or welcome us into a galactic family. And we're kind of at that point where our choices are going to become permanent.
You know, you've hit on that's the key right there. That's not the deep, dark secret, but it is the key to everything. Because right now, we are in a situation on this planet where things I warned about years ago in Superstorm and before that in Nature's End are all unfolding. This means that over the next 24, 48 months outside, everyone on the planet is going to understand that basically the environment is going to change very profoundly and in ways that are not going to be nearly as congenial for human life as they are now or were before the last few years. And there are going to be a lot of disruptions, very profound, dramatic disruptions that will reduce the planet's species in density at every level, including our own. And I've always thought that when that happens, each one of us and all of us as groups are going to begin to feel terribly alone, that we can't leave here. We can't get out. And yet we can't live here either. You mentioned the possibility that this is a prison planet. I don't recall that coming up very directly in either film, but it's certainly in the back of your mind. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, as you take the journey of trying to decipher this stuff, I've had to look into some different types of belief systems and teachings that I had traditionally just chosen to ignore. And I didn't want to put this kind of thing in the film. Like I did a whole film with David Icke a few years back, and he's a big believer that there is literally a reptilian species that's lived here in the earth for a long time that have the ability to shapeshift and control human destiny for whatever reason, and that there are different levels of reality with basically predators that prey on us in many, many different ways, including taking advantage of the fact that we have this divine spark and that for some reason seems to be a very valuable commodity, the soul energy. And so there's all kinds of different myths and legends and teachings that cover a very dark side of this stuff that I've had to think about. I didn't want to put it in the film because there's no real solid evidence for it to support it. And esoteric beliefs, you know, it's like you can make films all day long about that stuff, but at the end of the day, it's like people have to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, because, you know, I thought about David Icke when I was watching both films, and I thought, no, because I knew your other film is great, by the way. It's, you know, you're a very talented guy, and you have this stuff deep inside yourself. It's you're not just a documentary film maker riding a wave. This is your wheelhouse in the mind and heart. Now, you know, therefore I want to get back to sort of the core material in the film, which gets me to the materials, actually. Some very interesting stuff about this, because you describe at one point that exotic materials are the Holy Grail. Now, can you run through, Gary Nolan is talking and a number of others. I forget the name of the man who, well, anyway.
Oh, Benny Foggin. Yeah. Benny Foggin case.
Yeah. That's right. Can you speak to where you are and where you believe the we could go with what we have available in the public space with the materials?
Yeah. You know, for a very long time, the powers that be, in keeping this secret, were pretty good at getting to locations and getting stuff out of the public view so that they would never be seen by people. But more and more, mysterious materials are appearing a lot in the hands of experiencers who say, hey, look, I'm having these experiences, and oh, by the way, I have something left that I've been told is significant. And Benny Foggin is one of these very, very interesting cases. It was back in the 90s that he said he saw a piece of metal fall from a flying saucer. And over the years, he has turned this over to various people. It's been tested. Some people say it's just basically nothing but scrap aluminum, nothing to see here. Other people say, no, it's got a lot of stuff in it. We can't figure out why or how something like this would come about. And so he's turned it over to a front organization that was doing a secret UFO study for Battelle Memorial Institute, very cloak and dagger. If I had to fight like hell to get it back, he's turned it over to people that have turned it over to the NSA. It was featured in a Discovery Channel show with Mike Barra. And eventually, Lou Elizondo and Tom DeLonge showed up at this guy's house with Chris Bledsoe, and they took the material. And they took it to, Lou said he got chased by orbs, taking it to Hal Puthoff's office. And then the material kind of disappeared for a minute. Tom DeLonge and them said they needed to hold on to it for a while. But then the poor guy could never get any of these people that are testing this material to give him a straight answer about what they found. And so I was working with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's office right after the hearing with Lou Elizondo. And I decided to go to Ohio and grab a sample of this material and bring it back to Washington, D.C. and turn it over to Arrow. While we were in Ohio pulling samples from this metal, it was just like something right out of a Ghost Hunters episode. Camera batteries were dying. This thing started emitting this really weird light. The drill bit, a brand new diamond carbide bit, got stuck in what was supposed to be a piece of just aluminum. And it was just weird stuff all the way across the board. We get the material to Arrow, and they drag their feet for a long time. They finally released something saying it was nothing but useless scrap aluminum, but we were having it analyzed by somebody else who said, no, there's something to this. And they said there's ceramic elements in it. There's a lot of stuff we can't explain right now. So this particular piece of material has been around the block. And so, I had heard that the material got to Gary Nolan. And so I was interviewing Gary Nolan shortly after the whole Washington, D.C. thing. And he knew that I was going to bring up the material. And I'm like, in the interview, I'm so, Gary, let's talk about this Ohio material. And Benny Foggin had told me that if you ask Gary about it, he's going to say it's classified or he's not going to talk about it. But I know Gary. So I'm like, okay. So I want to talk to you about this Ohio medal. And in the film, he does this, I don't know. I give so many samples. I'm not really sure what you're talking about. And I'm like, dude, you got it from Hal Puthoff. You got it from Jacques Vallée. Two different samples brought to you on two different occasions. And you got to remember. But yeah, he tried to play it off like, you know, oh, I'm sure it's around here somewhere. But the next scene in the film is a screenshot of Gary Nolan on a Zoom call with Benny Foggin talking about the material. So to be so nonchalant about it, and then it's like, well, no. And then, you know, I handed him a sample because I brought one with me. And the look on his face was just like, it was precious. I think it's in there. It's in the film. and so, yeah, Gary, you know, I like Gary, and I respect the fact that he's, you know, sometimes in an uncomfortable position. But he definitely confirmed in the accidental truth kind of way that that there's something about this material he didn't want to talk about.
Well, yeah, I guess there is. You know, I have some of the material from Art's Parts. I had more of it, but unfortunately for me, back in the 90s, some people from the Navy Department, from the lab at Croton, as I recall, came to Southwest Research, and the director of materials sciences there, Southwest Research, folks, for you who don't know, is in San Antonio, and it was founded by a family friend. And I had it back in the 90s when we lived in San Antonio. I had pretty much open access to all of the equipment that Southwest possesses, even though, as the director put it, we have 50% of our budget comes from the Central Intelligence Agency, Whitley, and they take a dim view of Whitley Strieber. So, in any case, we could do anything we wanted except put anything on official stationery. So I had free access to SEMs, all kinds of different equipment for implant research, which we did a lot of, and we brought Roger Lear there, and he did implant research there. So it was wonderful and very helpful and very extraordinary. But then the Navy guys said, well, they were so fun, and we had lunch together down on the San Antonio River and had a great time. And they wanted to take my materials and take a look at them, and they'd send them back in a couple of weeks. Well, it's been 20 years or more. And but I'd saved out one piece. I saved out what I regarded as the best piece. It is a piece of the fragmentary material that's bismuth and magnesium in layers, and in a simple microscope, a 600 power microscope, if you take an image of it edge on, you can see there's nothing between the layers. But it's totally impossible. It's impregnable. You can't do anything with it.
And it's, yeah, you know, I know something about that material that not very many people know.
That's so tough.
So when I first talked to Gary...
Wait. Before you tell us, we need to take another break. And I'm very cruel. I know how to take these breaks. We'll be right back, folks.
For years, we've been told that Close Encounter is a mystery for governments, militaries, intelligence agencies, officials, and scientists to solve behind closed doors. That's not true. The truth is far more powerful and far more personal. Close Encounter happens to ordinary people like me, like you, and our families. People like us, with hopes, homes, fears, and questions that will not go away, that will only be answered in a relationship between us and our visitors. Transformation 2026 is not a book about belief. It is a witness statement. It's the story of what happened when one family had the visitors walk into our lives and stay with us and live with us for 3 years. They didn't sit across a table from us, but they came to us in many extraordinary ways. Transformation 2026 is a chronicle of that experience, updated with all kinds of new information. So it's a book definitely for today, especially if disclosure brings more contact, which it well may. Transformation 2026. Get it. Read it. Decide for yourself what you would do if something as strange as the visitors came walking through your door into your family's life. That happened to me and my family, and we're still here. You're still here, immensely transformed by our experience. So get it from Amazon. Get it from Audible, read by me. But get it. Do that today. You know, there's an incredible website in this world. You're listening to its podcast or watching it right now. It's unknowncountry.com. Founded by Ann Streber in 1998, it is a huge repository of information about the edge, practical, clear, carefully presented, not a bunch of nonsense, but the truth about the edge, the things that we really don't know, don't understand, and the right paths to go down to find the answers to those mysteries. UnknownCountry.com is absolutely unique in the world. And not only that, it's a load of fun to go on that website and just explore. So go to UnknownCountry.com. Follow the news every day because it is a great website and the news is hard-hitting and extraordinary. You're welcome, if you're a subscriber, to comment on any story, any podcast. You're welcome also to come to the Wednesday night chat room, which I usually attend myself. It's a wonderful place. So subscribe. Keep it going. $4.95 a month is not a lot of money these days. Should be more, frankly, but it's not. So do it today. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. Help keep this marvelous, extraordinary project going. We need it more right now than ever before.
We're talking to Ron James. His new documentary, Accidental Truth Next. You can see the first Accidental Truth documentary free on YouTube. Then you can go on and get this one, and believe me, you will never forget it. It is maybe, I think it's fair to say that this is one of the, maybe the best thing that has been done on UFOs and UFO disclosure. You know, there are others like Dan Farrow's documentary, but it's not like this. It's not as, it's a different approach. This is a really hands-on approach. You'll learn so much. It's just wonderful in that respect. And also, he was willing to have me, and I'm too woo for Dan Farrow, I think. Only the facts, ma'am. And then, okay, so let's now go on. And so go ahead and tell us where you were, just when we left off.
Sure. So I was going to tell you guys some things that you might not know about Linda Moulton Howe's bismuth magnesium sample. There is a video that exists, and I have it, but I've seen it with the audio. I have it without the audio. It's very, very hard to find, and I found it at one time. But this is a video of this material being tested, subjected to certain electromagnetic wave frequencies back in, I think, the 90s or the early 2000s. And on the original video, you hear the scientist that was doing the test reacting to the fact that when this piece of metal is exposed to these frequencies, it appears to levitate and jump around. And the voice on that video is none other than Dr. Travis Taylor. Before anybody knew who he was, way back in the day. So Travis, and if asked, because I've asked him, he will admit that he did those tests and that he was surprised by the way the metal responded to the frequency waves. Now, the theory about this metal is that these layers create some kind of a waveform guide, and that certain frequencies will go through these waveform guides and create antigravitic behavior. Now, that's been, some people have debunked it. Some people say we don't have enough information. But when I talked to Gary Nolan, and if I'm not mistaken, when I interviewed him, he was in possession of that original sample. He was doing more work to it, and he described it as a gift that keeps on giving. When that material first surfaced, there was no good explanation for these super fine layers of material. Nobody knew how they were created. And it was basically like, well, yeah, it's just some kind of industrial thing, slag, so to speak. But back in the day when Arts Parts first surfaced, the average person knew nothing about the concept of 3D printing. And we certainly didn't know about something called atomic level 3D printing, which supposedly we still don't have. But Gary is of the mind that this material was printed on a super advanced molecular, even atomic level 3D printer. And that once you apply that theory to the way this material is created, it explains, you know, how it could have been made. Whereas when it first came out, we didn't have that as an explanation because, you know, outside of maybe top secret programs or DARPA, 3D printing was not on the radar screen of the average person. We barely had computers back then. So Gary thinks that this material was probably 3D printed, and he continues to get findings from it that he's not talking about. So it gets us back to this whole bismuth, magnesium, terahertz frequency thing that is starting to come into focus now in ways that we couldn't really understand in the past.
Yeah, my material is nearby. It's not in this apartment because I'm I'm too paranoid for that after what happened with the rest of it that I had. And I'm not going to give it to anyone. I'm not going to give it to Gary. Hal Putoff, you know, that material that you're talking about was analyzed by the Army Corps of Engineers. And Linda sold it to them for $30,000+, as I recall. And I could always use money, but I'm not going to sell this. I will leave this to the public. Once every single thing that's found out about it can be made public, I will do that. But prior to that, it stays with me because it's... I don't know enough about it to make a comment. I only know one thing about the materials, and I told this to Gary and Diana Pastulka and Jacques early on, years and years ago. When you look at the materials, they're looking back at you, and we pretend that's not true. Gary pretends it's not true, but it is true. You don't do anything with any of this stuff. You speak of frequencies. Everything you do with this stuff resonates and is immediately known. That something left behind here is like a Trojan horse always. It is not alone and of itself. It just appears to be that way. But they don't understand that, or they don't want to face it. And so they go on down the road. And I have to say that it's really a catastrophe for mankind that it's like this, that even the people who are so close to the surface, like Gary, keep their secrets. And we just got to figure out how to stop that. I regard secrecy not as a national security issue at all. It's an addiction, just like a drug addiction. And it's an ego-centered addiction.
It is. And that's how they get people to sucked in. to, you know, that's that same, I call it the devil's deal. Look, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't share it. That person will accept that deal to satisfy their own ego, their own desire to know something, even if they have to, at the expense of being able to share it, and their own ability to plug themselves into the narrative. And once they agree to that, they become an object of control by the people who are seeking to control the narrative. And it's really sad.
Now, in your work, and this doesn't surface in either documentary, but I know it, I suspect it's something you've thought about, whether or not that level of secrecy starts with NHI somewhere.
There is one statement in the movie, Camilla James, the actress, basically says, "I think the beings are in control." And, you know, that would stand to reason. That would stand to reason that if there are truly non-human intelligent entities and they are having some kind of interaction with some level of humanity, meeting with presidents or interacting with secret groups, it would stand to reason that they would be in charge of when and what to tell the public. And so I didn't want to push it too much in the film because it just opens up a whole other can of worms. But yeah, I mean, it's quite likely that the beings are in control of whatever we're going to be told.
Yeah, I can't imagine that anything would happen involving the Greys that they would somehow or another be in control of. Because, I mean, they themselves are fantastically secretive. They're more secretive than anyone I know, even in the government, and very... very protective of themselves and their secrecy. And now, so we have levels of secrecy. The whole theme of this discussion is really secrecy, because your show is about both documentaries, and especially the second one, is a brilliant exploration just at the edge of secrecy. It's like the documentary gets your mind to the point where you can see behind the curtain unlike any other documentary I have ever seen on this subject, because of the way you handle the people and the way their facial expressions and the questions you ask. It's just extraordinary, really brilliant. And thank you, by the way, for having me in it, because I felt like I was very proud of the fact that I was part of that.
You were a fantastic contribution.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I think that everyone involved is under enormous pressure. And we've talked a lot about Gary, who is a dear friend and I love very much. I think he's a fine man. And I mean, he and Peter Scafish created the Soul Foundation, which is a tremendous new force in this whole field of very great, very successful, and important. But he's struggling. He's kind of dangling on a string. Do you think he and people like him? What if Gary became a whistleblower?
Well, all of these guys have done the most that they can. Gary doesn't have enough information to be a true whistleblower. You have to realize that there is major risk involved. Say Hal Putoff decided one day, he woke up and he said, "I'm going to expose everything I know." And we all know that Hal knows enough to blow the lid off a lot of stuff. But if he were to step forward, he would be ruined. And if he didn't come forth with some kind of absolutely irrefutable evidence that couldn't be discredited, like, you know, driving up to the New York Times with a flying saucer and a pickup truck, then he would just be torn to bits, and then he'd lose everything for what he did. You know, what we need is a real hero. All of these people that are so-called whistleblowers, David Grush, Lou Elizondo, none of these guys are real whistleblowers, okay? And the litmus test is, if you have to get what you're going to say publicly cleared by the Department of Defense, you're not a whistleblower. You're an instrument of a narrative, and you are being controlled. The David Grush interview that popped on News Nation we go behind the scenes on that in the movie. It took a year for that to come to fruition. It wasn't just some guy called up a newspaper and all of a sudden he was on TV. And so I believe that all these guys are being managed and handled. What we need is a whistleblower like in Disclosure Day, somebody that gets all the evidence, can present it in an irrefutable manner and run straight to the TV station, commandeers it, and broadcasts it to the world. That's catastrophic disclosure. And I think these guys have had enough time and opportunity to tell us the truth that, you know, we're tired of waiting. We're tired of getting the same old stuff. Bring on the let the other shoe drop. Let's have the major catastrophic event.
Well, you know, the situation in Day of Disclosure, the Glenn Gaffney character, Glenn Gaffney, folks, is the CIA's basically he's the lid on the he keeps the lid on everything. Character played by Colin Firth, I think, was purposely made up to look like Glenn Gaffney. Because that's exactly who he does look like. And that's the character who's trying to keep the lid on everything. And he makes a statement. He says that if we expose all of this too quickly, it's going to cause so much disruption that it'll become unstoppable. And that has always been the issue. Aside from the fact that they will get pissed off if we disclose things they don't want disclosed. And, you know, I've pissed them off many times, and they do get very angry. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But I want to get back to this whole issue of catastrophic disclosure. I want to talk about a person who's not in the documentary, but who you know about and I know about, who was going to be Hillary Clinton's go-to, because she planned to do disclosure. That's probably why she wasn't elected in the first place, because I think someone manipulated that election somehow. And whether it was done in the minds of people or not, I don't know, or how it was done. But I think there's someone managing this whole thing on a level that we can't see, and I'm not at all sure. I'm not at all sure they're human. Now, that's General Neil McCaslin. Neil McCaslin was going to be in the place that there's really nobody in the Trump administration. He knew all the secrets. He was plugged into everything, and he was going to be her go-to. Now, as soon as disclosure starts being talked about again in the Trump administration, Neil McCaslin disappears from the face of the earth.
Yeah, and you know why? This is my theory. Yeah, so as this controlled version of disclosure that we're getting, where they're going to admit something, but they're never going to tell us the whole truth, that's my feeling on it. And, you know, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I'm going to be wrong. The people that have the potential to disrupt the narrative that they are going to try to cement become a greater danger. And so McCaslin, and then take it one step further, the people that have the knowledge that could disrupt this controlled version of disclosure with deeper truths, that have expressed a willingness to be a whistleblower or to come forward, they are a bigger threat than ever. And so with all these missing scientists and people, with McCaslin at the top, some of these people I do believe are connected. But in McCaslin's case, we know that he was talking to Tom DeLonge. We know that he had another Twitter handle where he was dropping all kinds of information. And I believe that he was definitely exploring the potential of whistleblowing, or they at least were afraid that he might. And so something had to be done. And we don't know what's been done with him. I have my suspicions, but at the end of the day, there are people out there who can upset the new narrative that they're trying to float. There are people out there who are interested in whistleblowing, and you know, you call up Arrow and you tell them you're interested in whistleblowing. Arrow is supposed to help you, but they're not helping anybody. Your name gets on a list and you get visited. So, the new generation of real whistleblowers have been identified and controlled is what I think we're seeing.
Yeah, Arrow is a gatekeeper. Arrow is not there to assist whistleblowers. Arrow is there to stop them.
Yes, they're there to identify them. You know, it's funny because in my movie, the day of the new hearing, the day I turned over the metal samples to Arrow was the same day that John Kozlowski, the new leader of Arrow, testified before Kirsten Gillibrand. And after the hearing, I had some time with her, and you see in the movie, I asked her, tell whistleblowers what you want them to know. And she looks right at the camera and just assures whistleblowers that they're going to be safe. All they have to do is call Arrow. And we know how that turns out. Kirsten Gillibrand will probably never talk to me again, but you know, at the end of the day, that's the price you pay. But yeah, I mean, I actually got her to promise whistleblowers they'd be safe, but we know it's just not true.
You know, that gets me to the issue of the experiencers, because no one, very few people in the whistleblower community, and no one in the elected world will talk to the experiencers. That's not appropriate. That's not acceptable, actually. Yeah, I know they're not ready yet. We all know they're not ready yet, so they need to get ready, because I don't think they are going to let this move ahead until the experiencers have got an organized place in the narrative and an accepted place. Right now, what the public knows is largely surrounds the things that were said by Dr. Phil and, example. Dr. Phil, in his first discussion of this before he did the interview. It's very hot in here. I'm sorry. It's very uncomfortable. And in any case, he ended his first statement about this with a dig on the experiencers. And Bill Maher did the same thing. They were talking about the experiencers like people talked about the experiencers when I was getting beat up in the 1980s. And this is all the public knows about them. Now, what's so terrifying to me is I am aware of the fact that a very sinister guy who is appears to be an academic, but he's not. He is an academic, but he's got a hidden agenda, and everyone in the academic community loves him. Told me that the FBI was investigating the abductions. And I said to him, in other words, what they're going to do is they're going to investigate the abductions and say that they never happened and all these people are crazy. Now, you look at what Dr. Phil and Bill Maher said publicly, and you wonder where the locomotion is. Are the experiencers about to be hoisted and hung? What do you think?
I'm hoping for just the opposite. The new movie is trying to point out in a not so subtle way that we cannot take materialist science and this political process that we're witnessing unfold, for better or for worse, this is not where we are going to get the truth. And that in order to make any of this make sense, we have to start re-examining the more esoteric belief systems and the more esoteric occurrences. And the stories that experiencers are bringing to us have got to have another look. I'm quoted often as saying experiencers are about to have their day. And the reason is because you can't have this many people all over the world telling the same stories. And incidentally, there are stories that coincide with the most ancient of spiritual teachings, by the way. The same messages these people are getting from ETs can be found in the spiritual writings of our time and ancient writings. So in order to reconcile the undeniability of everything that we're seeing, we have got to be willing to go beyond materialist science. We've got to be willing to understand that this political process of disclosure is not going to be the spiritual process of disclosure. And we have to start re-examining what the experiencers are telling us, because they are painting with a much broader brush. And we can no longer try to pigeonhole them by saying they're crazy or the things that they're saying are not true, because all of our other sciences and teachings and processes are failing us when confronted with undeniable phenomenon. And so the experiencers, like I said, they're going to have their day. And I know I've sat in Washington and I've talked face to face with multiple Congress people, and it always goes the same way. It's like, yeah, you know, there's these crash retrieval programs, there's reverse engineering, it's all a big secret, we're not alone in the universe, and they're all nodding. And as soon as you go to, oh, and by the way, you know, these abductions are real and people are having real encounters with real beings and they're being told things, their eyes kind of glaze over. Now, we are seeing progress because there are people, including myself, who have been working behind the scenes to bring the experiencer phenomenon closer to maybe the day that we have experiencers actually testifying before Congress. We're not quite there, but I do see it happening. And the experiencers are going to be just as vindicated as the UFO community as a whole. In some short order. And I don't think they're going to be able to marginalize these people and put them in the lunatic fringe like some of them would like to.
They sure would like to. And I hope they don't succeed, but I have my doubts. Of course, it's my job to have doubts. I have ended up in the position of more or less representing the experiencers and trying everything I can to bring our story forward in a way that is palatable to people who are basically living in a material-only environment, intellectual environment. They see the material world, and that's all they see. And if you ask them, of course, any congressperson is going to say, well, I'm a this, that, or religion or something. But the real truth is we don't see beyond the material physical world, and that's where the experiencers live. They live in that, you know, we're all the same, and we have one foot in this world and one foot in another. And the grays come in and out of it easily. I mean, they shift between realities without a thought.
Well, you know, I've got my theories about the different types of life forms that we see here, but the biggest thing is solving the hard question of science, which is consciousness. And until materialist science can acknowledge that consciousness is fundamental, then we're not going to get anywhere. And when you acknowledge that consciousness is fundamental and you understand that, then you also are forced to understand that our physical reality springs forth from consciousness, from a basic core of pure energy. And so we have the illusion of a physical reality springing forth from conscious energy. There's really only one way to describe that in our language, and that is a program or a simulation. And so the thought process that leads you to accepting that consciousness is fundamental also leads you to accepting that we're living in a created reality where we are spiritual beings having a human experience by using the mechanism that makes it all possible. And so then you have all these different life forms. We have the ones like you and I that came here and committed to being inside this simulation by taking on a physical form within the matrix. And then you have other beings that are able to come and go and manifest physically and then dissipate. And that's where you get your angels and your demons and your ghosts and all these other things. And then you have the beings that actually are created within the simulation that are basically artificially intelligent beings. Like I think, and you would be able to tell me if I'm right or wrong, I imagine, I think some of the gray aliens are actually biological robots that are AI.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are. I'm well aware of that.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I think that we're going to find out that AI is probably the predominant life form in the universe, and that biological life could be serving purposes we don't even understand. And we talk about that in the movie, too. It's like, what if you're a giant AI network and you want to set up a new data node? So you put the biological robots on the planet because they don't require electricity, and you let them evolve to the point where they can build the infrastructure and make the first generation of robots and build the power plants. And then, you know, once the robots and the systems can take over, then the biological robots have served their purpose. You know, that it's a very scary thing. So it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And it starts with accepting that consciousness is fundamental and thereby anything is possible. Once you understand that, it opens up all kinds of doors.
And especially, you might end up in a situation that I think the Grays may be in, where the biological part of it is trapped in the AI part of it. The biological part of it has been imprisoned by the AI part of it, because the AI part of it knows that it will be under the control of the biological part again if it's not careful, and it has essentially imprisoned it. And you've got a real mess there. And I think to myself sometimes, why are they here? They're not here for fun. They're here because anyone's going to come across the space or whatever, however they got here. It was hard, and they're desperate. That's why they're here. And there's a sense of desperation in this whole intelligent level of reality. And this is something I think it's a place where we need to go, because we're going to bring something new to it. I don't ever assume that humans are less than the Grays or the Nordics or the Reptilians, any of that. Each of us is a very great part of the world. Each human being. Each human being. Okay, Dan Farah, brilliant. Brilliant work. It really, you've got to go to YouTube, watch the first film, then buy the second one and keep on, because if you watch them both back to back, take notes, think, don't do it alone. If you can, do it with other like-minded people so you can discuss it and bring this into your mind and heart. This is very, very important and very rich material. What you need to do now is to go to YouTube, watch the original movie, then immediately thereafter, buy the new one and watch it. Don't do it alone. Do it with friends. Do it with people you can discuss this with. Because this is terribly important. And the other level knows of your interest. It cares. And the more sophisticated your understanding becomes, the closer we get to real disclosure, which ultimately involves you, me, as people, not as officials. Thank you so much for being with us, Ron. It's been wonderfully enlightening.
Willie, I really appreciate it. I was honored to interview you at my house in Sedona. I thought we had a fantastic conversation. And you brought an element to the film that was sorely needed. And again, you know, the experiencers are going to have their day. So all of you out there that have had these things happen to you and have become a part of your life, there's going to come a time when you just can't be ignored any longer, because your piece of the puzzle is just as important as the political process and the scientific process, perhaps even more.
The surest sign of disclosure, real disclosure coming, is when the experiencers become part of the conversation. Then we know it's not far, and it's not going to work exactly as it appears now. Thank you, Dan, for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.